Well, grab a Bible this morning and open to Genesis chapter 38. Genesis chapter 38. We're trucking through Genesis. I don't know if you feel this, but I feel like when we got to Joseph, it was like we're on the downhill slide. I feel like we've been in Genesis for a long time. And now I can kind of start to see the light at the end of the tunnel. I don't know if that's you or not. Genesis chapter 38. We did start the Joseph story last week in chapter 37, which kind of is a misnomer because really it's chapter 37 started as the fulfillment of the Jacob story. And that's how our sections in Genesis are divided these are the family records of dot, dot, dot. And the last section is the family records of Jacob, not Joseph, but it sort of highlights this one son of Jacob as if he's the most important character in the story for the next 13 to 14 chapters, except when you get to chapter 38. So we've seen in chapter 37 that Jacob highly favors Joseph, but Joseph is hated by his brothers who kidnap him, who sell him into slavery, where eventually he ends up in Egypt, which is quite the introduction to the next generation of God's chosen people who are meant to be a conduit of his blessing to the world. This doesn't seem like this is going in a very good direction, does it? The ringleader in chapter 37, you might remember, was a man named Judah, a brother of Joseph. And then in chapter 38, we get to this one strange, obscure chapter where while the fate of Joseph hangs in the balance, Genesis zooms in on this one other brother, Judah. The question is, why? Now, some scholars would say that chapter 38 is an unimportant interruption to the good story of Joseph, that we ought to skip it altogether. In fact, the first page of one of the commentaries I saw this week was that this is good for deep Bible study, but preachers who are preaching to congregations would do better just to move on to chapter 39. I thought, well, that's not really where we go with things here, because we think that there is no wasted ink on the pages of our Bibles, right? That every word is here for a reason and that God can use it for the building up of his church. So a few days ago, I overheard a friend who pulled out his phone and said, "Hang on, I'm going to videotape this." And I thought, I have not heard that phrase in a long time. Videotape? Like, I think if my kids heard that, they would go, "What are you talking about, videotape?" He meant he's just going to video it, right? Like, that's the shorthand now, just video it. Well, back in the day, for you kiddos, when we wanted to capture a moment, even before we had phones, even before we had video cameras that were accessible, we had just regular cameras that weren't phones. They were just a camera, and most of them were bigger than phones are now. And that's all it did was take pictures. And the reason it was so big is because it wasn't digital. It wasn't where you could just take pictures and delete pictures and take pictures and delete pictures, but you had to use a specific set number of pictures on a roll of film. Some of you guys are feeling a little nostalgic. You had a roll of film. Ask your parents or grandparents, but what used to happen is we would take these photos and capture these images on this film, and then we would take that roll of film to somewhere like a Walgreens or a 1 Hour Photo or a drugstore or something where they could develop those for us. And then they'd call you an hour or a day or a week later or whatever it was, and they would say, "Hey, we've got your pictures ready." And you hadn't even seen these pictures yet. All you did was take the picture, and you get this little envelope full of these pictures that you've taken. And then in the very back of that envelope, do you remember what that was? Some of you just, do you remember? It was the negatives. The negatives. Thank you. Now you have just taught me what generation is most prevalent in the room. The photo negatives. It's the original film strips that are the original representations of how the camera captured the light when you took the photo. Because in cameras, what you do is you open up a lens for a set amount of time, and it captures light, all the different kinds of light, and it translates that into an image. The photo negative is exactly that. It's like a reverse of the light. It's the negative. So the dark colors look bright and the bright colors look dark. So it's the reverse of the image, and you can use that then to develop more photos. Now, in Genesis chapter 38, what we find is a photo negative of chapters 39 and following. Judah, who Genesis focuses on in chapter 38, is the negative where it highlights the darkness compared to chapter 39, which focuses on Joseph again and highlighting the light. And so what we find in chapter 38, like a photo negative, is highlighting for us the dangers of darkness as the story of God's redemption begins to develop. So Judah's story highlights humanity's spiral due to sinful choices. So we're going to see the downward trajectory that sinful choices cause when we read chapter 38. So let's begin in verse 1. It says, at that time, which is meaning the time that Joseph was sold into slavery by his brothers, at that time, Judah left his brothers and settled near an Adullamite named Hira. There Judah saw the daughter of a Canaanite named Shua. He took her as a wife and slept with her. She conceived and gave birth to a son, and he named him Er. She conceived again, gave birth to a son, and named him Onan. She gave birth to another son and named him Shelah, and it was at Chetzib that she gave birth to him. Now focus on the first two verses there. At that time, Judah left his brothers and settled near an Adullamite named Hira. Now, there's something here that we see, which is a sinful choice that Judah makes right off the bat. He left his brothers. Now, what matters in the book of Genesis is the family that God has chosen through which to bless the nations, which is the family of Abraham. And we've been tracing through Genesis the genealogy of Abraham and the story of God's blessing, where even when God's people through this family of Abraham choose not to follow or choose to disobey, that somehow God works in that miraculously and sovereignly to bring about his purpose and to continue blessing his people. Well, Judah just takes off. I mean, he sold his brother into slavery. He was kind of the main guy in that story going, guys, we could kill him, but what if we didn't kill him and we got money for him and then we made everybody think he was dead? It's kind of like the best of both worlds, right? This is the kind of person Judah is. And then from that moment, he takes off and he goes and settles near an Adullamite named Hira. And this is his second bad choice. And you can begin to see the spiral deepening. He associates himself with this Canaanite man. Now, up to this point in the story of Genesis, God's plan has been to carve out for himself a people, to keep his people holy, to separate them from the world in order to build and grow a people for his own possession, in order that he could bless them and then send them to the world as a blessing to the world. And so Judah, right off the get-go, he leaves and then he associates himself closely with a friend who's outside of God's people. And so we think this is probably going to go wrong for Judah at some point, and then it gets worse. Verse 2, there Judah saw the daughter of a Canaanite named Shua, and he took her as a wife and slept with her. We go, well, it's not bad for a man to be married, right? And no, it's not, except for the wisdom in Genesis so far is for the men of God in the family of Abraham to avoid marriage to Canaanite women. These are like the women that you don't want to bring home to mom and dad, okay? In fact, this is what Judah does, is associate himself more with his uncle Esau than he does with his father Jacob. Remember how Jacob and Esau kind of butted heads and Esau took off? Do you remember what Esau did because he was angry at his parents? He married Canaanite women. And that was what he did to rebel Well, here Judah, the son of Jacob, does the same. He aligns himself more with his uncle Esau than he does with the line of family blessing that's come through Jacob. So things are spiraling for him. And he takes this wife. If you've been tracking with us throughout Genesis, I hope you noticed the two words in verse 2 that stand out the most, which is that Judah saw the daughter of a Canaanite and he took her as a wife. Do you remember that in Genesis chapter 3, this is the same thing that Eve did when she saw the fruit on the tree and that it was good to eat, and she took it and she ate? It happened again in chapter 6, the story of Noah. And right before we get to Noah, we've got these God men, right? These Nephilim, and they see the women and they take them as their wives. This is not a good thing. This is a sinful action. It happens again in chapter 16 with the story of Abraham and Sarai, when Sarah gives her maid servant to Abraham as a wife. It happens again in chapter 19, in the story of Lot and his daughters. We're seeing, like, when it looks like sin is at its worst, what's behind it is when humanity sees sin as an option or sees something they want and they take it for themselves. This is an expression of the original sin from Eve, that we want to choose autonomy from God, that we know what God has provided, but when we see something that we want, we take it. So this is where Judah is heading: sinful choices. And it begins to spiral. So, chapter 38, verse 3 says, she conceived, his nameless wife, the daughter of Shua, she conceived, gives birth to a son, he named him Ur. She conceived again, gave birth to a son, and named him Onan. And she gave birth to another son, and named him Shelah. And it was at Chetzib that she gave birth to him. Judah got a wife for Ur, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. Now, just, you guys got to forgive me, because I'm going to try to say Tamar, but I'm East Texan in my core, and so Tamar is going to come out, okay? So just track with me, all right? Same person. Verse 7, now Ur, Judah's firstborn, was evil in the Lord's sight, and the Lord put him to death. Then Judah said to Onan, sleep with your brother's wife, perform your duty as her brother-in-law, and produce offspring for your brother. But Onan knew the offspring would not be his. So whenever he slept with his brother's wife, he released semen on the ground so that he would not produce offspring for his brother. What he did was evil in the Lord's sight. So he put him to death also. Now you can see right away how things have begun to spiral out of control because of Judah's sinful choices. Because this is what happens when humanity chooses sin: things spiral. Ur is noted as being wicked. The kind of wickedness that he exhibits shares some wording from the kind of wickedness we saw in Genesis chapter 19 with Lot, and the wickedness of all, mostly of the sexual kind, happening in Genesis chapter 19. And so we know Ur is not a good guy, and we see God's judgment come down on him. Well, some people go, what? How could God do that? Why wasn't God more patient? And we're going to see the patience of God here. We're going to see the grace of God here. But isn't it good to know that if you're in the midst of an evil world, that we serve a God who will punish evil? Like, evil's not going to win. And so there's a good thing happening here that we have to recognize. It's not just about, oh, poor Ur. Ur made this choice, right? And then we get his brother Onan, his middle brother, who again is totally selfish. And everything about his relationship with Tamar was about self-gratification. He didn't want to provide children for her, even though that was her right as a now a grafted in family member of the family of Jacob through Judah, who had given her to his son Ur. It was her right to bear children for that family. This was what she now was created to do. This was her purpose in life. And then Onan takes all that away from her by the choices he made in their marriage. living totally selfishly, right? Keeping in his mind, the keeping from having children meant keeping his portion of the inheritance. This is a traditional marriage type in the ancient Near East that later is codified in the Deuteronomic law for the Israelites, but it also was happening in nations around where the Israelites lived, where if a firstborn had a wife and then that person died before children were born to that wife, that that wife would have the right to the next in line, and that middle son or that next son would be able to have that relationship with that woman and provide children and then take on the name of the older brother so that the double portion of the inheritance could be given to that child in place of the brother. That's all a confusing way to say that this did not usually end well. So that next son, if everything was pure and holy and right, would say, yes, I am willing to give up my life and what I thought my life would be for the sake of my family, for the bigger picture, for the work of God in the world. But what happened here with Onan is none of that. Instead, he said, you know what? This is my chance, and I'm not going to give anything that is due to me for the sake of my family, which sounds a lot like his dad, who had just run away from his family. So, like father, like son. In the meantime, as he chooses pleasure over purpose, we've got Tamar, who is the victim again, victimized by a second terrible marriage to a second wicked man who uses her and, get this, prevents her from fulfilling her own calling as an ancient Near Eastern woman. This is what Alyssa Whitehurst says from our Longview campus. If you notice, a lot of times when I come to passages like this, I'm getting some advice from some women in ministry, and because these are tough topics to cover. And Alyssa shares some great wisdom here as she shows us the role, what happens to Tamar here. She says, it's one thing for Onan to forego his role in this marriage, but it's another thing as he has robbed her of stepping into her role. And she says, what a cruelty. So this is the kind of wickedness that we're dealing with as humans choose sin and it spirals out of control. Judah probably thought, life is going to be better away from my brothers. I mean, all this competition, all this, you know, family drama, you know, all this keeping up the lie about what happened to Joseph. You know, what if I could just get away and just start over? What if I could just start fresh? And he didn't trust God for making all those things right again. And it led to this downward spiral. So and Onan, but then there's another son, right? Shelah. Let's look at what happens here in verse 11. Then Judah said to his daughter-in-law Tamar, remain a widow in your father's house until my son Shelah grows up. For he thought he might die too, like his brothers. So Tamar went to live in her father's house. So here we have Judah again with his sinful patterns just spiraling out of control, because we thought Onan was bad by shirking his responsibility. Now Judah, along with his sons, is also shirking his responsibility. Now what he says initially sounds right to Tamar, like, hey, go back to your father, which is translated, I don't want to be responsible for you anymore. Go back to your father and live there. And when Shelah grows up, because he's obviously very young now, then you can have him. And your right to bear children will be fulfilled in that relationship. Except the end of verse 11 gives us this little window into Judah's mindset, which is that if he can just put Tamar off for a while, that probably what's going to happen, because of what's happened to both of his other sons, is also going to happen to his third son, and then he's just going to be free from this debt forever. So Judah, in his sinful choices, spiraling out of control, digs this hole deeper and deeper and deeper for himself. He's also here favoring and protecting his youngest son, maybe even overprotecting his youngest son, which, by the way, might sound familiar to you because that's what Jacob was doing with Joseph in chapter 37. So again, like father, like son. So he doesn't intend to fulfill his duty to Tamar, which is equally as dehumanizing to Tamar as Onan's physical sin with Tamar. So you might even remember where in verse 5, Shelah was born. Just this interesting little note. Chetzib. Why would it note where Shelah was born and not the other two brothers? I just find this fascinating. The translation of the Hebrew word Chetzib means to lie, to deceive, to fail, or to prove oneself as a liar. And so it was almost like the story was being told from the beginning that Judah would be unable to follow through on his responsibility, that he would be lying about what he said he could promise Tamar when he brought her into the family. And so he is failing as a father, failing as a patriarch. He is, in all accounts, just like his dad in that he becomes the deceiver. And so you see, it's a generational downward spiral of sinful choices. Sin creates a vortex that pulls everything and everyone in your life down. And this is just a simple application of what's happening here, is that when we choose sin, when we choose to reject the ways of God, when we see what we want and we go after it thinking that I have the ability to make the best decisions for my life as opposed to trusting God's way for my life, then you've got to recognize that the spiral, the vortex begins to happen, like the momentum picks up and then more and more things like a tornado are going to be scooped up into this, and it never is isolated to just you. Sin never stays isolated to just you. It always has residual impact. And we see that clearly in this chapter 38. So this is one of the things that we're noticing when in the photo negative, as the darkness is highlighted, we see this clearly. Sin affects all of our circles of influence. It never stays isolated to simply us. Now the spiral continues as we get into verse 12. Look at verse 12. After a long time, Judah's wife, the daughter of Shua, died. When Judah had finished mourning, he and his friend Hira, the Adullamite, went up to Timnah to his sheep shears. Tamar was told, "Your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep." So she took off her widow's clothes, veiled her face, covered herself, and sat at the entrance of Enaim, which is on the way to Timnah. For she saw that though Shelah had grown up, she had not been given to him as his wife. When Judah saw her, he thought she was a prostitute, for she had covered her face. He went over to her and said, "Come, let me sleep with you," for he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. She said, "What will you give me for sleeping with me?" "I'll send you a young goat from my flock," he replied. But she said, "Only if you leave something with me until you send it." "What should I give you?" he asked. She answered, "Your signet ring, your cord, and the staff in your hand." So he gave them to her and slept with her, and she became pregnant by him. She got up and left, then removed her veil and put her widow's clothes back on. When Judah sent the young goat by his friend the Adullamite in order to get back the items he had left with the woman, he could not find her. He asked the men of the place, "Where's the colt prostitute who was beside the road at Enaim?" "There's been no colt prostitute here," they answered. So the Adullamite returned to Judah, saying, "I couldn't find her. And besides, the men of the place said, there has been no colt prostitute here." Judah replied, "Let her keep the items for herself. Otherwise, we'll become a laughingstock. After all, I did send this young goat, but you couldn't find her." About 3 months later, Judah was told, "Your daughter-in-law Tamar has been acting like a prostitute, and now she's pregnant. Bring her out," Judah said, "and let her be burned to death." And as she was being brought out, she sent her father-in-law this message. And we'll stop right there. We see here Tamar victimized not only by and by Onan, but again by Judah, not allowing her to fulfill her role in this family. And what she does in response is not commendable. She had the right motive. In fact, I'm a little bit amazed by her commitment to this motive. Number one, that she had the right to bear Judah's children, his heir, and then also kind of amazed that she still desired to be in this family. One of the reasons that wisdom for God's people in Genesis not to marry Canaanites is because when you intermarry with a Canaanite, the identity as God's people tends to drift away from God and look more like Canaan. But in this instance, we have a Canaanite woman who is more interested in being identified with God, so much so that she goes to these extreme measures. And so she may have had the right motive, but she certainly did not have righteous action. But she likely, as a Canaanite, did not have the spiritual foundation that you might expect from the descendants of Abraham. So in response to her incessant and to her traumatic sin that was happening to her, she's left grasping with straws. You know, what else could she possibly do? Maybe the only thing she knew how to do, maybe the only thing that people had valued her for, she chose that path. And that tends to be what happens to us. When sin happens to us, we get sucked into that vortex and it takes us on a downward spiral. So she takes matters into her own hands because that's how she was treated by the people of God. Now, to this point in her life, not a single person, not a single one of God's people in the family of Judah had shown her that God was to be trusted and obeyed. So she attempted again, just like Eve, to take matters into her own hands, and it ended up pulling everybody down. Judah enters the scene again, and he's still not looking any better. Sin keeps taking him down. He and his buddy Hira are going to the sheep shearing at Timnah, which, by the way, for us East Texans, is, I would say, closest to what you might know as a cattle branding. Anybody's been to a branding party? This is like, you know, you're living the country life. Everything is work. You're always working. And so you got to take something that's work and make it fun, right? So you just kind of turn it into a big party. This is what the sheep shearing was. And they're heading up, and she has placed herself in his path. She's got a deceitful scheme that she's working. He is unaware, maybe even inebriated at this point. And so, no, there's no excuse for that. It's just evidence more of the deep sin that's happening. And he chooses again to defy God's plan for marriage and sexuality. And the cycle just keeps spinning. The vortex keeps spinning. He's going deeper and deeper on the spiral of sin. And he chooses this path of knowing this prostitute. And then I think he's probably thinking, as he's had time to grieve from his spouse and her death, that there's probably ways to justify this action. You ever been in a situation as a sinful person where temptation is presented and the first thing in your mind isn't to run away? The first thing that comes into your mind is, well, you know, I kind of deserve this. Like, things have been really hard for me lately. Like, I need something good, you know, everything in my life has been really emotionally draining. Like, I just need something to feel good. And there's ways that we like justify sin, and we try to choose our brains are amazing at like tricking us into thinking that these things that are fleeting are actually things that will be fulfilling, and it's never how it works. And so here he is on this trip up to the sheep shearing, and he's probably going, hey, no one will ever know, right? I mean, after this, I'm going back home to my family, and nobody's ever going to know this happened. He's probably thinking it's just like a business trip, you know, like it's a night or two in a hotel by myself. Who's going to know the difference, right? I'll just do what I want, and then I'll be back to normal. Everything will be okay. But guess what? Sin never lets itself stay secret. Ever. It always creates this spiral, and it sucks everyone and everything into it. We see how Tamar, her deceit, led to Judah's delusion, and so much so that he would give her his ring, his cord, and his staff. You may not think that's a big deal. Any one of those things individually would be a big deal. If you met someone on the street today and they said, hey, you know, I'm going to do this service for you, and you know, it's not going to cost you much today. You can pay me later, but in the meantime, just leave me with your driver's license. Okay, that's like one. That's like the ring, okay? And they go, and actually, if you would also give me your Social Security card, then that would be a good deal too. And more than that, not even your driver's license or Social Security card, how about your credit card too? Like, if you leave those three things with me, then sure, you can pay me later. And this is what Tamar has done to Judah. And Judah, so deceived by his own desire, gives in. And he leaves all this with her. And what Tamar and Judah's sin teaches us in this moment is that sin always costs what's most valuable to you, and it always leaves you more vulnerable than ever. This is the truth about any sin. It always costs what's most valuable to you. Tamar's life, you can read the story and see what it cost her. In Judah's life, obviously, cost him greatly. And it left both of them more vulnerable than ever. Like, two wrongs don't make a right here. Like, it's just the spiral's deepening. So we see too how this plays out. Judah doesn't go away lightly. Like, he shows up, he's acting like everything's good. Like, he had just had this, you know, this soiree, and then now he's back to normal life, and 3 months later, he hears that Tamar is pregnant. What's going to happen now? Well, to make sure that he continues to look good, he shifts the blame toward her. And he overreacts. Did you see how he reacted to this? He said, she's been acting that way? She needs to be burned to death, which is an extreme, extreme punishment reserved for only the most extreme of sin. In fact, nothing ever prescribes that punishment for that sin. It was him that made that leap because he was so afraid about what might come back on him. And at this moment, totally unaware of what might come back on him, but I'm sure an immense internal guilt. And so he's probably embarrassed by his own lack of self-control. He's been completely derelict in his duty to his family, so he shifts the spotlight onto Tamar, and as if he hadn't dehumanized her enough already, he calls for her death, meaning he really did not value her life at all. He had a total disregard for Tamar's life, and that's pictured clearly here. So this sin trajectory, which started off so innocently with just one man leaving his brothers, going against God's wisdom, choosing his own way, has led to the destruction of lives. And this is the trajectory of sin. This is what humans' sin leads to. Now, keep in mind the photo negative. And if you're here next week, here's what you're going to begin to see. All of Judah's story so far is the photo negative of what we're going to see in Joseph from chapter 39 and forward. We're going to see in chapter 39, this is what Richard Pratt points out in a table that he built, is that when Joseph flees from foreign women in chapter 39, we see in chapter 38 that Judah has associated with the foreign women. When Joseph lives with sexual morality, we see how Judah gives in to sexual immorality. When Joseph is victimized in chapter 39, we'll see in chapter 38, just now that we've read, Judah is a victimizer. When Joseph experiences God's blessing in chapter 39, we're going to see today, and we have already, that Judah experiences God's judgment. When Joseph is falsely accused by a woman, we're going to see in chapter 38 that Judah is rightly accused by a woman. And then finally, when Joseph rejects sin in chapter 39, we see here in chapter 38, the next few verses, that Judah has not only committed a great sin, but then he has to confess this sin. And this is the turning point. Like, just when we think Judah has reached rock bottom, as it is in Genesis over and over again, God turns the story to hope. To hope. So, this is what we see. Sin leads to that downward spiral, but we also see how God's sovereignty comes through a second chance. God's sovereignty comes through a second chance. The final five verses of the chapter point us this direction. Even though humanity consistently chooses to reject God and his ways, God continues to pursue them. He works in all things to bring us back into a relationship with him in order to bless us and to restore the whole world to blessing. This is what the book is all about. So let's look at how it happens, beginning again in verse 25. As she was being brought out, she sent her father-in-law this message: "I am pregnant by the man to whom these items belong." Uh-oh. And she added, "Examine them. Whose signet ring, cord, and staff are these?" Judah recognized them and said, "She is more right than I, since I did not give her to my son, Shelah." And he did not know her intimately again. When the time came for her to give birth, there were twins in her womb. And as she was giving birth, one of them put out his hand, and the midwife took it and tied a scarlet thread around it, announcing, "This one came out first." But then he pulled his hand back. Out came his brother. And she said, "What a breakout you've made for yourself." So he was named Perez, which means breaking out. Then his brother, who had the scarlet thread tied to his hand, came out, and he was named Zerah, which means either the brightness of sunrise, or it could mean like an orange or like a yellow glow or even red. So we just think like bright, okay? So we've got Perez and Zerah. Now, what's going on here? Obviously, she presents essentially the photo ID of Judah to go, "Are you really going to call for my death, Judah? Because if you would, just like you asked your father Jacob to examine the bloody coat of your brother Joseph, examine these items and tell us who the guilty one is. Is it Tamar?" Well, we know she's guilty of some sin, but Judah must recognize his own sin in this moment. And the reality is, as he realizes the justice of God, which had already been revealed in his son Ur and then in his son Onan, is knocking on his door. Sin never stays in the dark. He thought he could cut his losses, but his identity was forever linked with that sin and vice versa. I want you to think about this as we wrap this up and we turn towards hope. Just, I want you to think for a moment about sin, especially sexual sin today and the way it plays out in our lives. I want you to think about all the identifying data that is linked with sexual sin today. I want you to think about credit card histories. I want you to think about search histories. I want you to think about IP addresses, social media algorithms. I want you to think about platforms that you use, apps that you use on your phone that know which images and videos you linger on, even if you don't click on them. And can I just say that what the choices we make every day, a lot of times when it comes to sexual sin, is much like the one Judah made that day where he gave up his staff, his cord, and his ring. It's like we are doing that over and over again. And can I just tell you, friend, one day it is going to come out. Privacy is a myth. If you haven't realized that, I think it's okay if you choose to set all the privacy things on your phone. That's great. But we should not be surprised one day when the things that we have done in private are brought out into public, because sin never stays in the dark. And so does that terrify us? It could. Should we overreact to that? Maybe. That's what Judah did. Or is there a better way forward? Knowing what we know about the deepest, darkest corners of our hearts and how sinful we are, that when we come into church, it's not because we're coming because we're good people. We're coming because we're broken people who have lived in darkness. We've experienced the worst of ourselves. We've shared the worst of ourselves with other people. So what ought we do with this reality? What do we do when we are exposed? Is there any recourse? Is there any hope? And the answer is a resounding yes. Because guess who knew about every sin in chapter 38 before it was exposed? God knew. And God knows. And it is God who orchestrated the exposure of this sin, not so he could say, "Gotcha," but so that when everything else is lost and the unstable foundation on which we have built our lives crumbles to pieces, God will be the only thing we have left, and he will always be there saying, not "gotcha," but "I've got you." He is our only hope, and we must turn to him. Look at Judah's response. Verse 26, to the exposure of his own sin, it was immediate. He knew he had nothing else to stand on, and he confesses. He admits his sinfulness, and he reverses course. And in doing so, he not only lays down his own pride, but he also lifts up Tamar. She is more right, which is literally righteous. She is more righteous. He once again, he turns from dehumanizing now to dignifying. He turns from hiding his sin to now being okay with his sin exposed, because it's not up to him to deal with it. And God, who's been working all the while, turns the story from a story of sin and a spiral out of control to a story of hope, a hope-filled story as an ending to a hopeless story. He sees that Tamar, knowing she's pregnant, gives her the blessing of twins. He restores her reputation, her dignity as a human being, and her role in God's plan to redeem all of creation. She's identified as the more righteous one in this chapter, but then more than that, God never forgets Tamar, and he doesn't want us to forget her either, so much so that in Matthew chapter 1, in the genealogy of our Savior Jesus Christ, Tamar's name is there. She wasn't a Hebrew. She's probably a Canaanite. She wasn't reputable in her time because she had been treated so poorly by God's people, but God put her name there. It was an intentional inclusion because God rewrote her story from one of scandal to one of salvation. And it was intentionally an inclusion in Matthew 1, along with several other scandalous non-Jewish women, revealing just how gracious God is to the whole world, that his story is not just to save a certain group of people, but that through that group of people, he would then extend salvation to the ends of the earth. So this is where God is headed, to redeem the whole world and restore it all to himself. And Tamar is a perfect example of that. But not only was her life redeemed, Judah's life was redeemed. Judah was restored to his brothers. The next time we see Judah in Genesis, he is with his brothers. He is traveling with them to Egypt. They are in search of food to survive the famine in the promised land. And that's where they meet Joseph, the one they had sold into slavery, who they had convinced their father was dead. They've been lying about him all the time. And in Genesis chapter 44, of all the other brothers, it's Judah who leads the way with humility before Joseph, not even yet knowing who Joseph was, seeking help, seeking redemption, seeking sustenance, and through Joseph, God provides it all and restores the family of Israel and establishes them for hope. The truth of this story is that there is redemption for sin. Sin is a downward spiral. It creates a vortex that sucks everything and everyone you know into it. And it's destructive. Yet God can rewrite your story of sin. Only God can rewrite your story. And he can turn it from a story of just crumbling pieces into a story of hope and salvation. Your sin has never spiraled too far for God to reach you and save you. And so the call today, as we see the photo negative of Joseph's story, we pick up next week and go forward, is to see it in ourselves. What if a light was shown into your heart, exposing the dark corners? What would develop? I hope by God's grace that the story of Jesus Christ is what comes out. Because though we have sinned, and though our sins be as scarlet, God, through his Son Jesus Christ, can wash them white as snow. He can forgive us. He can restore us. He can redeem our lives. So the call today is, in light of the story of Judah and Tamar, to be restored to God through confession and forgiveness, which is free and available to all by Jesus Christ. Would you pray with me? God, we thank you for redemption. We thank you that you are good and holy and just. We thank you that you are truth. And God, I pray that our lives would be adjusted to that, and that we would see the potential for our sin to be exposed not as bad news, but as good news. That we can walk in freedom because of who Jesus is and his work on the cross to bring forgiveness. So Lord, we come to you humbly, asking you to expose what's dark in us, bring it to the light, so that the story of Jesus can shine through. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.